Welcome to the Awake versus Aware show. We're taping on June 28th, 2025, and one of the fun things we get to do is talk with other consciousness and mental technologists from around the world. And we have the pleasure of speaking with Winter here today. Love his writings and what he does. And yeah, tell us a little bit about yourself, your interests, hobbies, passions, and how you got into these kinds of technologies.
Hi. Yeah, I've always been interested in dreaming and in like alternate reality since I can remember and since before I had a word with it for it. I remember being very, very young, you know, when you have memories of being like 5 or 6 years old, and you know you're that age because you can remember how tall you were. I don't know if you guys can remember that when you're You have memories of being beside the kitchen counter, and you know that your head didn't make it past the height of the kitchen counter. So I remember being that tall, and looking around the room, and literally feeling like there must be something else, like not only this thing I'm seeing physically, and wondering a lot about that, and being lucid in dreams at a very young age. So. And nobody taught me that. I never spoke about it with anybody or wasn't taught about it. And then when I was about 10 or 11, I found a book in my parents' library, which was about it isn't the famous book on this, but it was a book on Soviet research on ESP and all of that. And it had a bunch of exercises, like basic exercises of mental influence on bodily state. That's how I phrase it now. At that time, it was just for me interesting experiment on how repeating phrases and concepts would make your body's sensations change and need hypervisualization techniques and all of that. So that's actually how I got interested in all of this. But I also grew up in a very I would say it was a Puritan Christian household. So not only was this very taboo, I mean, it's weird because the book was in my parents' room, in my parents' library, but the whole thing was seen in a very suspicious light, and I myself got very scared. I don't know how I got scared because I had like bouts of lucid dreaming, some that were when I was very, very young, they were spontaneous. But when I was in entering puberty, or I think it was earlier than that, pre-puberty, whatever you want to call it, around the between 9 and 11, I'm not sure. And it was too. I again, I didn't read it anywhere. I didn't watch a TV program on it. I was not instructed in it. I was having nightmares, recurring nightmares of an invisible monster chasing me. It started to crystallize very clearly, a witch following me in dreams, and I was terrified of it, and I started to lose sleep because of it. And then I just decided to gain control of the situation because I thought it was ridiculous that I was running away all the time in my dreams, and it was hurting my sleep, and I didn't like it. And so I started to decide to control my dreams. Like nobody taught me, and it worked. And very quickly I gained very deep control of the dream. Like I started like doing that, like to the point of seeing stuff. Do you remember the movie? What's that famous movie of Inception, right? Where the practitioners or the adventurers have the power of deciding there's going to be a building here or stuff's going to go away. I got to that point when I was that age. And then weirder steer things started happening because I started flying, and I remember meeting a figure that felt particularly alive to me. And I remember waking up after that and saying, I think I'm going too far. And that's because I was in a Christian household, and I was a believer, definitely. And I thought, I don't know what I'm getting into. And I got very afraid. And I just consciously, willingly decided, no more lucid dreaming, no more. I mean, I didn't call it lucid dreaming. I just said, no more of this stuff. I'm going to close this door. And I just shut the door. So that's how, I mean, I think that's where the root of my interest comes from. More, it's very instinctual, I think. So later, excuse me. Later on, when I encountered occult things, it was I knew there was a door in the occult, but also I saw a lot of what I thought was silliness, quite frankly. So it was a kind of like a love and I don't want to say hate. It wasn't hate in for the occult, but rather, oh my God, how am I going to sift through all of this and find something that tells me where to go? So I think that's a summary of how I see the origin of my interest in all of this.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it made me reflect on some of the things that happened to me as a kid too. But with your dreaming and altered states of consciousness experiences as a kid, this was automatic. Just through willpower and just intending to do so, these things happened.
Yes, I think when I was very, very little, like 5 years old, I think this was just spontaneous. I don't remember astral projection per se as a 5 year old, but I do remember lucid dreaming into the not con not super controlled, but being aware that I was dreaming, you know. And then when I was in a waking, I mean, now I recognize these experiences as logical, in the sense that I realize now that some things that that in the lucid dreaming community we are encouraged to do when we are in our waking lives, that enhance the possibility and the clarity of dreams. Because when I was that young, I had the I wouldn't say autistic, but that tendency that certain kids have to just look at everything with fascination, you know, look at the walls, look at the ceiling, look at other people, and you're just like kind of dumbfounded by everything, but you're really paying attention and very, very much self-aware. You know, I remember doing things like when I was very, like, yeah, around that time, 5 to 7 years old, our family lived in the countryside, went to live in the countryside because of my parents' work. And our house had a lot of space. I mean, like kids could walk and just play around in the street in front of the houses. And I remember getting into the habit of lying down on the floor and looking up at the sky, and just getting into the sensation that I was going to fall in the direction of the sky. And I don't know why. The physiology of children is so sensitive, but I remember getting so scared because I mean, I did it for fun, but then I got scared because I really had the sensation I was going to fall into the sky. And around this time, I had a lot of flying dreams, I think. So yeah, I think it's a combination of having a certain propensity and curiosity that wasn't taught. And then old when I was older, right, as I said before, it was yeah, as you said, you used the word willpower. It was a combination of willpower, but it was fueled by fear and having to stand my ground against the nightmare figure. Yeah, but I just want to add that when I tried to do this when I was in my 20s, I only had like weak success. And it only got to the point of lucid dreaming. I think when I was a teenager, it really got to the point of that I now recognize at least some of those experiences were astral projection, because the vividness when I was a teenager, because I feel like the level of realness sensation was quite marked in a few of them. So It's a mix of intention, but I think the now I see that the distinction between what I would call now failure and success was that it got it wasn't it, it was willpower and decision to the point of that knowing. Because if I not right now, I could repeat 1,000 times, I'm gonna be lucid in my dreams, I'm gonna be lucid in my dreams. And that sort of works. Psychic driving, pure brute force psychic driving can have an effect. But I think I don't know how I did it, but I was better able to shift something that I am tuning into more recently also. Well, I was able to shift my what would you call it? Belief. Compass. It's. I think some people call it just knowing. To know in the occult sense, when you just know something. I know this is how it is. That way of that certain people who are into magic say, and so it is. It isn't just an ending. It's actually a statement representing a shift in consciousness. So yeah. Willpower, and it's more than willpower, I think.
Yeah, no, totally agree. Kalis, did you want to add anything to or ask Winter anything?
I just think that's all very, very fascinating and very much in keeping with a lot of us that are engaged with this kind of work. It starts very early on. It just seems to happen. There's no real rhyme or reason. The catalyst that you mentioned, the fear-based aspect of it is not all that uncommon. I think a lot of people at very young ages develop some of these skills out of fear and terror. Like there's a sort of a haunting aspect to it, and it's a very fascinating adaptation to hear about. So yeah, no, it's all very, very awesome.
Did the religious upbringing do anything in terms of as a work as a springboard as a kid or teen, even as you're evolving with these kinds of approaches?
I'm not sure because as a Puritan Christian, because I wasn't, I think the different denominations of Christianity have different effects on the people who were raised in them. So a Catholic feels very differently, I think, than an evangelical Christian about certain things. And I use the word Puritan not in the sense that my parents would consider themselves that. I don't know if they would use that word. I call them that because of the extremity, especially on my mother's side. So I think because I had had these experiences and I had the instinct or feeling or a certain being sh not sure, but yeah, the feeling for this, and I was a very strong believer in Christianity at the same time. So I know I now recognize too that there was the taboo of the occult and all of that was very strong for me. Like it was very sexy for me. I would use that word. It felt like super seductive. And at the same time, I had that high trust in the divine presence of God, as seen from the perspective of a Christian. I would point out that my parents were the kind of Christians who early on we moved through different churches because they could. I would consider my parents smart people, not geniuses, but they were smart people. So they could spot when the pastor or the church was too much into money, or it was obvious this was more of an operation, a commercial operation then. And it happened so often, or there was a lot of dishonesty. And so we ended up having all of our weekly Bible readings inside the house. So they had that kind of streak of not just following authority. but at the same time being super loyal, or not super loyal, but very much into the Bible, and because of my mother, who was an evangelical Christian, into the aspect of praying and actually feeling the presence of God, something that in the past 2 or 3 years I have been able to tap into. Because, and I want to say it this way, I now see us everything being the same. What I thought was divine and Christian back then is the same thing as trying to have any sort of supernatural contact, the way I see it now. Because when you get taught, I was recently seeing into Stephen Greer's, Dr. Stephen Greer's stuff, regarding, he calls it level five, or what's this, extraterrestrial contact, right? So extraterrestrial contact of the fifth kind, in which it's initiated by the human. And in it, he talks about meditation and about setting the intention and trying to contact, trying to call. But when you get into all of this, the theory of all of this, the theory and practice of all of these different, from Stephen Greer, who's talking about aliens, to other more serious occult practitioners, it's always about mind shifting, and it's always about, like, you have to put yourself. Before you have the contact, you have to feel like you're going to have the contact. You have to know that you're going to have that contact. And years ago, before I reconnected with this idea, I tried stuff from around the occult, in which they would not give you these instructions. They would only give you, like, ceremonial and like the protocol of summoning entities, or the kind of weekend thing where you light candles and dance around in a circle, and then something's supposed to happen. But none of these groups, at least at the beginning or on surface level, actually talk about shifting your physiology and your structure of sensing from the inside out. However, in more recent times, I started to give more credence to my very real sensations and perceptions when being in Christian worship, for instance. I remember, I mean, countless times in prayer, Christian worship, if you're not just singing the words, if you're not just following the words in the Bible, but your mind and being is focused on the actual contact. Oh my God! I mean, you start to tingle all over your body. You start to feel like rushes of energy through your body. This is very, very, very real in terms of what a practitioner of what Christian, I don't know how to call it, experiences. My mother would speak in tongues, and I mean, there's the whole thing of feeling goosebumps, right? But I do recognize now that a lot of it was more than that. So the Christian upbringing, again, it made the occult sexy, but it now also gives me a frame of reference that's wider, and it doesn't vilify Christian practice beyond the fact that any ideology and any religion does limit you and blind you if you don't go beyond the words and instead look at the experiences. So that's what I need to say right now.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I wrote about this experience, similar experience, in a international journal. I think it was called Life Force at the time. The names do change, and it's out of print, but good luck finding it. Because as a kid, as a teen, I was big into, like, Catholic Bible study and doing the youth mass. And one of the cooler events was going up into the mountains and staying in a log cabin with other people your age, and you had, the counselors and this whole thing. And then, like, Saturday night, you'd have the big night of everybody going in the same room doing prayers, and then just the energy deepening and getting higher. And there's a very mystical, you had the candles there, it was dark, You're up in the mountains. It's very clear, clean energy. And then the part where you get prayed over, you're like in the middle. People will be around you, people speaking in tongues. And then I felt this wind or this push on my legs or something. And then they said, say you're supposed to like, just let it push over you. People will catch you and then, put you off to the side to recover or something like that. And then later on, I like shed some tears, like, okay, what's going on here? And that was like part of the whole thing of this whole mystical experience and people getting overwhelmed or it was and I wish at the time I would have gone further looking into it, but yeah, there's definitely a whole nother dimension or side of life that isn't as far as like the typical, you go to church once a week, wash your sins or whatever, and then that's that. But there is that other side if people want to go further. And that was a really cool thing. I wish they had that for adults or something, but that was one of the things that defined as far as my own what do you call it? Delving into these, the deeper meaning of reality. And did you have anything like that as far as that kind of explicitness and like those kinds of experiences?
I think I glossed over it probably, but when I say you mentioned feeling the wind and stuff like that. For me, especially when I was younger, because I think when I grew up into my later teens, like 16 to 18, I was so much a contrarian, and I was so much growing into atheism, that I blocked a lot of it, even though I still would have sensations. It was pretty normal for me to be so much as a kid, to be so much into worship, which was not for me. For me, it really was not a social thing. It was a relationship to God. So my body would fill up with like tingling energy. And being super, super, super high. That was a normal thing for me. And it doesn't mean it's not what you necessarily what you see in a Christian big mega church necessarily. It could happen in a very small group. It could happen at home. And I saw it happen a few years ago when I stayed at a Hare Krishna temple and I participated in their ceremonies, and I reconnected with that sort of energy. It wasn't as strong as when I was a Christian, but I did feel the same. When you start to let go of prejudice and you just start to reach out with your mind, but it's something else. It's not just what I would call your mind, it's something that comes from your chest, and you stop blocking it, and then you're filled with something else. A pretty normal experience for me, what you called wind and the tingling sensation of your body and being filled with something. That was pretty normal for in worship for me. And if I didn't have that, I knew that my mind was somewhere else, that something was wrong. It wasn't the exception, it was the norm for me as a Christian. And prayer, especially prayer in private with my parents, who were very fervent, who were not doing it out of protocol. My dad was a little bit of a protocolarian because he came from I'm not dissing Catholics, but it was very ritualistic for him. And still, when he laid hands on my head and said things, I was able to connect with that very much. I mean, when I grew into my later teens, I was so much of a contrarian that I would reject it, but I could still feel it. I guess I was very programmed as well. So even when I was angry with him and he would do that, I could feel the rush of energy from his hands through my head and down my neck and into my body. And that never ceased to be real for me, even when I was an atheist secretly, by the way, because I couldn't be an open atheist in that kind of company, or at least I didn't feel I could. Or praying in a group, because with the group, when I say group, I mean my family. For years, in my teenage years, we had weekly Christian meetings, but it was our family. It was my mom and dad reading the Bible to us. And it wasn't perfect at all. I mean, it was a very imperfect, it is, and it was a very imperfect family. But the moment of prayer always caused reverberations, very physical reverberations in my body. Like I could feel those waves. And I, of course, at the time, and when I was an atheist, I just said, okay, yeah, physiological impact, psychological priming, whatever. Even at that time, I didn't see it as some kind of energy. I just thought, okay, ooh, this feels good. I know this is the cool part of this. I think it was pretty normal for me, worship and prayer, and it goes beyond the Christian thing. I experienced it in the Hare Krishna context. I was never a Hare Krishna, but I participated out of curiosity, out of occult curiosity, in both their, I forgot how they call this. It's japa when they repeat the holy mantra with the beads. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. When you do that, and also the chanting, it very much summons energy if you connect with it. So yeah, that's my answer to your, that's my long answer. I think it's appropriate to answer in that detail to your question.
No, for sure. It's these discoveries that sometimes call here emotional crystallization inertias, ECIs. It's from the Church of Satan, their definition. And that's what I got into right after being a Catholic. It's like my spider sense was all about, you can't be preaching about giving to the poor and then be in this palaces of gold and enormous, this extravagant royalty. And then it's just fascinating how, you look into the Vatican and the Jesuits and the secret power of the world and what they've done in these secret histories. It's pretty astounding. And so I knew that as a kid, but was too busy at the time going into, okay, if this is what the quote unquote people of the light get into, what is the complete opposite?
Just because
So, I don't know. I don't know if that's Nancy, our person running the radio station for music. But yeah, tell us more about how you got more into these different explorations, consciousness, technologies, and things that worked, things that didn't work. Any highlights as to where you got to now?
I mean, I don't consider myself an advanced practitioner of these technologies by any means, really. I do notice that there are there I can have areas in which I feel like I'm totally lost, or like sometimes I will mention it because it will be cool to have certain abilities, but I don't really care. Actually, when I ask myself, I realize I don't really care. For example, seeing auras, I doesn't. I mean, as far as I see it as a marker of occult, what I think it might be a marker of occult development, I care about it, but the fact that I don't have the experience doesn't really bother me either. So how did I get into it? I don't know. I think. I had a streak of being very arrogant. So even when I was very interested, I had a very low threshold of for irritation when it came to reading occult stuff. Like I could not stand, I tried to start reading Crowley. I could not stand Crowley. I mean, as a teenager, I read Anton LaVey and I thought, this guy's an idiot. I mean, he's philosophically retarded, because at that time, I mean, I of course I had we had already in school you had already read Plato, Dostoevsky, that sort of level of thinking. So I felt like, even though I was didn't consider myself a Christian by the end of my teens, I felt I had a grasp on the metaphysical aspect of it, not necessarily super technical in the theological sense, but at least in the logical sense, in the same logical sense that allowed me to make myself an atheist. And I don't wouldn't say make myself an atheist, but reason myself out of the religious aspect of it. And so it was hard for me to find something that I could respect. I did not respect the writings of Anton LaVey at all. It was, to be honest, I felt it was retarded. And I only gained respect for Anton LaVey until very recently. And when I say very recently, I would say the last 5 years. So sorry, not very recently, but the last 5 years. Because friends that were very eclectic and who were very, in my eyes, psychologically open, psychologically healthy, would talk about him, but not in a, because I've met also like Church of Satan members that are like militant fanatics that remind me so much of cult members in other denominations. So I cannot get behind that. I had this friend who, I have this friend who mentions Anton LaVey as a human being, you know, who thought cool stuff, who thought useful stuff. So I read him again and I got some ideas, but I think what I got from Anton LaVey was more of a very human, not so much occult practice, but rather an approach to open-mindedness and independence that helps in exploring occult topics, I would say. And I actually just read rather widely and followed my instinct. I now say I was quick to exasperation and it came from arrogance. I now try to tap into what was making me exasperated. And now I think it has to do with an instinct, an intuition of what's working for me. Silva mind control was something that attracted me a lot a few years ago. I had the fortune of having read some basic NLP before it, so I also recognized some of its pitfalls, such as the fact that I like their training for basic meditation, which had to do with counting down and having strict discipline of meditating like 2 or 3 times a day. I also think their visualization techniques are cool, the discipline of practicing them, and then they have a discipline. It's like states, right? You first learn to meditate with them, and then you learn to visualize and make things happen through visualization. And then you go on to try to meet disincarnate entities or what they call guides. And you do it very actively. So they have that progression. But their visualization is all second person. That means even if you're visualizing something about yourself, you are seeing yourself upon a screen projected in front of you. And I thought this was the weak side of them, because it was all like watching a TV or a TV program or a movie. What else can I tell you? So yeah, Satanism. I read on Satanism, the Satanism of the Church of Satan, but I also read on other denominations of Satanism. I can't remember names, but I would say, rather than organizations, members who were very into the figure of Satan, but did not associate themselves with the Church of Satan and would explore other combinations of magic or ways of thinking, because one would, I mean, if you look at the Church of Satan, it's a very civil and proper institution, you know, and the Satan of Milton is a true rebel. It's not just the like a, oh, I'm gonna be nice and in society and and then I'm gonna look for my own profit. I mean, that's not the Milton of Satan. That's not the Satan of Milton, and that's not the Satan of legend. The Satan of legend is probably a guerrilla. How do you call it in English? Guerrilla fighter, right? In my view, it comprehends more than just the individualist of modern society, even the ones who are, one could say, true assholes. But so I felt there was a very wide world to explore too much, really. I didn't care about becoming a master of anything in particular, but rather looking. I knew I was always looking for something that felt useful and true, but I could never put it into words. So different denominations of Satanism. I read on Sufism. I didn't practice Sufism. I did most of the stuff I didn't practice. I went into different. I privately tried different meditation disciplines, and one of the most useful ones was the Zen, the Zazen, right? Just sitting down. Learning to do it was very extremely useful, I think. And then in recent years, recommended by a particular community, was the practice of basic Qigong, not even Qigong, right? But the Zhanzhuan, the basics of Qigong, and the precursor to true Chinese martial arts, the standing meditation, they call it, standing like a tree. I think that was extremely useful in my experience. And being guided to not just power through it, but to feel, to increase sensitivity in standing Chinese meditation rather than powering through willpower. I think that's more what it is to me. I read Stephen LaBerge. I don't even know how to say his name. LaBerge, Stephen, the
Yeah,
guy
that's
who
right.
did, right? Because I had my own experience with lucid dreaming, and it was very, it came like from the gut. My lucid experience was gut founded and heart founded. That when I read the protocols of Stephen LaBerge, I was like, and I tried some of the things about like recognizing dream signs and all of that. It was so clunky and meant like mind based, like remembering things, and it was, and I never it never worked for me. And when I tried it was because I thought, okay, I'm gonna get into something that's reasonable and it's proven to work. But it didn't work. I mean, it just bothered me. It just distracted me. And I every time I start lucid dreaming again, it's because I relax completely and I just know that I can lucid dream. Again, know with a capital K, which is the occult thing where you're doing a shift of some inner sensation or inner instinct. So yeah, lucid dreaming, organically reading about different denominations of occult practice. I think philosophy helps as well. But I guess I don't know if I'm answering your question. I'm trying to
Yeah, no,
gather what it
absolutely.
was. I'm trying to gather what was meaningful to me. I've mentioned this in occult forums online sometimes that there's a book I'm gonna get you while you're talking next time. I'm gonna try to look for it, but it was a book. It's a modern. It's a 20th century philosophy thesis that has to do with a guy discussing a philosophy doctorate or whatever. It was his doctorate thesis, I think. Speaking about how logic and reason, these are tools that can be made to justify any idea, and you can start from any idea and derive a logical sequence of beliefs and rules, so that what we need to understand is that logic itself cannot tell you truth and it cannot guide you to anything in particular. It's just a tool for deriving something that makes sense within a framework. That's all. And this was mind-blowing to me at the time because I thought, wow, it's true. I mean, actually, that book got me out of atheism, because I realized atheism was just a construct within a very tight set of actions, and that is true about any set of beliefs. So that was crucial to me. I'm gonna look for it, and I'm gonna give you the name. I don't know if you have a more specific a question, because my answers are kind of long and very general, because I'm trying to capture everything. So tell me what you
No,
want
this
to
is good.
know.
Yeah, I'll let Kalis come in after I talk, but no, it was the evolution and the process of discovery and these crystallizations and these landmarks as you're trying to get more consistent results and outcomes. And like you mentioned, the movie Inception, let alone Christopher Nolan's vast catalog, especially when it comes to consciousness and how to project that on the screen. I mean, even like what was that one? Gosh, with not it was like time travel. I wish I remember. Oh, Tenet. That one was like next level above Inception. And the exception part, at least for me, was like the dream within the dream, and how to and I've experienced this numerous times where you're in a dream, but in that dream you fell asleep and you're in another dream, and then you go like climbing ladders, you know. It wasn't per se that the movie influenced it, but it was, you know, that discovery thing. I'm hearing this music like every time I talk. What is that? Are you guys hearing it too? Like
Yeah,
only when
I
I
can hear
talk.
it, but I'm muted, so it's not me.
Yeah, I mentioned to the radio station host about it, but anyway, that's funny. Anyway, no, this is good. You're answering things completely as far as like the direction I'd like to go. Kalis, any input and similar experiences you've had? I mean, because it's I feel like this is almost a universal, you know, people have these experiences and then usually brush it under the rug or dismiss it. But no, these things are, you know, like the process, even after physical death. Go
Can
ahead.
I can I interrupt you for
Yeah,
a
go
second
ahead.
and on the technical matter of the music, because I have two mute ways of muting. I can mute on the Zoom thing here with the button. I think you guys are using that mute, and I can mute on the microphone I'm using. Now I'm outside in a shop. What kind of music are you hearing right now? Just to confirm, maybe it's me,
I think it's a
because
female
I
singer.
it's here. Yeah, I'm outside at a cafe.
It's not too bothersome. It's like I just want to know where it's coming from. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
You don't have
it
to
was
mute. It's
here.
up to you. Okay, no problem. No problem. Oh, so anyway, Kalius, you want to add to what was being discussed?
Yeah, and I think the whole circular nature of these realizations is fascinating, because you can start out at, a very, very juvenile sort of rebellious perspective, with the Church of Satan, for example, was a springboard. For me personally. And you can get a little older and a little wiser, and you can start to see from experience all these central themes embedded in everything, even the things you were rebelling against. So it's fascinating to see, like people like Neville Goddard, for example, highlighted the fact that the Christian Bible, the New Testament, is perhaps one of the greatest psychological documents ever written. And there's so many comparatives to Neville Goddard's interpretation of the New Testament to Zen Buddhism and all sorts of other philosophical documents. And so it's fascinating to come to that realization when you realize that, oh yeah, all the stuff that we're talking about, mental technologies, energy work, lucid dreaming, might not be referenced directly. There's a good deal of metaphor involving a lot of these things. But they're present in pretty much every major religion. You were mentioning the sort of the chanting. That's just one. It's energy based. The whole thing is meant to bring about a certain energy in mass. And so where do we see that theme? Throughout major religions, we see it all over the place. We see the sort of Gregorian chanting, in these, massive cathedrals that seem to be clearly built with this intention in mind. So
Have you
yeah,
tried
absolutely.
Greek, have you tried even as an amateur Gregorian chanting for spiritual reasons? Try it. Try it. You're gonna get spooky results. I can tell you.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's something to all this stuff in everything. And so it's really a mark of, I think, a sort of spiritual and mental and philosophical maturity to understand that, yeah, no, this isn't one side or the other. These themes are pretty universal in everything. So it's something, it's actually quite an incredible realization to come to. And so I don't try to knock, one side or the other, or break things down into good versus evil, or any sort of ridiculous sort of dichotomous terms. Yeah, these things are very much all over the place. They're everywhere. So I really do appreciate your input regarding all that. And the thing you mentioned with philosophy has a very interesting way. I don't know if you've heard any previous shows that we've done, but Stoicism, for example, the ancient Greeks. I don't know if you're familiar with Peter Kingsley, or if you've read In the Dark Places of Wisdom.
I
You
started it. I'm familiar with the nature of his work, but I haven't ever read halfway through any of his books.
Yeah, there's an interesting occult connection to, the cult of Pythagoras and, all these key and maybe not so well known philosophers of the time. And so there is that component. And then what do we find later? We find, later Christians adopted a lot of these philosophers' ideas into their writings. So it's
Have you seen an interview with Peter Kingsley that's on YouTube? I think it's the only one. There's probably a few. Have you watched it? One in which he's sitting on a couch with a books behind him, I think, and he's very relaxed. Have you seen that?
Oh, yes.
Because he basically explains the core of what he's getting at in a very tight moment. And I think if you're a constant meditator and a seeker for these things, and you're very sensitive, you catch what she's talking about. You remember that when he just goes quiet and he says, "There," like in the silence or something like that. Like that's what you're trying to get at. Do you remember that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a sort of like it's not desperation's not the right word. It's like it's there's a sort of, I would say, almost like a franticness in what he's saying, but it's so calm and relaxed. He presents his points almost like in a very urgent manner. Like he wants to make this known, but he does so very calmly. And it's a weird, I'm not really sure what the word, I'm not a wordsmith. So I'm not really sure what the exact, type of description you could put into it, but it's very, very fascinating to watch. And if you meet him in person, he's very much like that all the time. Like he's got this sort of calm urgency about him, if that makes any sense. And yeah, I picked up on it very, very easily. And there's always, especially with someone like him, there's always this. I mean, the first thought I had was like, this man clearly knows something and he's not telling us. You get that feeling from him, like he's just a big bubble of energy, really. And but he's very controlled, very calm. He's got good control of himself. So that's very obvious, it's very apparent.
Yeah, it would be fascinating meeting him then. Yeah, but by what he writes, the fact that he's been onto this for a very long time, because his first book, his thesis, that it was based on, I guess it was based on his doctoral thesis, the one before In the Dark Places of Wisdom, the one in which he really goes into the theory of the aether, and not in a modern sense, but in his own reading of ancient aether and the five elements. I can't remember the name of the book. Something about Empedocles, and I read a few chapters of that and kind of got the idea. So yeah, it would be fascinating to meet him.
Yeah, let me add to
Yeah.
that,
Oh, go
because
ahead.
I
Go ahead.
did attend a few of his when he was, I think, was either visiting or living up in Northern California, and he was doing some workshops, in-person workshops, in the dream incubation. Yeah, fascinating guy. I mean, he's exactly as he is, even meeting him in person. It's like he's you know how in dreaming when you're running or walking slow and it's like you're underwater. He's like that in person. And then if you look at his eyes, it's like these two bottomless wells. You know, it's just you get just hypnotized, kind of mesmerized or something. It was just like, okay, this guy's walking between worlds or something.
We're talking about Peter Kingsley, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yep,
Okay. I was
definitely.
wondering because I didn't know he did workshop. So when you said that, I thought,
No.
huh? Are we talking
Long
about the
time
same
ago.
person?
I shared it in some forums about, hey, he's doing this. I mean, I think he posted it in his official site, but that's where a lot of the recordings came from that he's offering. Hey, I need to call Nancy just to double check on something technical. It'll just be a few minutes, but yeah, no, this is a good discussion. So you guys keep going. It'll just be a few minutes.
Sounds good. Yeah, no, I always go back to that whole circular realization, you know, when it comes to, I mean, for me personally, it was, you know, the, you know, some a lot of folks in this type of space have experiences of, you know, visitation or, you know, a constant theme, whether it's the same thing or it changes, the theme is usually pretty much the same. You know, I had a very similar thing when I was young. I pretty much had what I would call a mentor that I would dream about haphazardly here and there, off and on, for most of my childhood. And it was never anything serious. It was never a serious setting. The setting was always different, but the person was the same. And I could never see this person's face. And it wasn't until about maybe 10 years ago where I had another similar experience, and it was in a like a, an alleyway in New York City. I recognized the place, I recognized the venue, but the person stepped out of the shadow and showed his face for a moment, and it was mine. And that I woke up with this incredible, like just thinking about it now, just it felt like the most ridiculous anchoring sensation you could imagine. I felt very heavy. And so ever since then, I've been having night sight experiences very, very not haphazardly, but off and on, actually quite randomly, where I'll have a non-lucid encounter with a child. And I've always wondered, is this me talking to me again? You know, like this is very, very odd. Now, I never really injected any sort of personal philosophy or any sort of ideas into the experience itself. You know, there's a lot of ways to frame it, there's a lot of ways you could label it, but I've never bothered to do it. I've always just basically just tried to see the experience as an experience. I've never tried to dissect it or attach meaning. But in the latest ones where I'm basically speaking, I'm having conversations with children. It's the theme is very interesting because we see this with people like Whitley Strieber, where he's in a group setting, you know, with other kids, you know, being visited by these beings. Other contact phenomenon speakers have very
Right.
similar themes, and so I'm not choosing to do this. This is just happening. I'm not lucid, and during the experience, I don't become lucid, and so it's very, I mean, it's a common theme. You know, there's some, again, like with the religious aspect of it, with the dogma aspect of it, there's a lot of crossovers with this stuff, you know, even with the UFO phenomenon and the whole contactee phenomenon thing. So I find that very, very fascinating. Yeah, what do you think?
Several things came to mind when you were. First of all, I think that experience you have, that's specific. I'm sure you've had others in which you grew up seeing this figure, and then as an adult, you started dreaming of the kid. I think this is very special. This is, I mean, it's a treasure. That's how I put it. These experiences are treasures. First of all, that, and second of all, I was thinking that the fact that you, as an adult, aware of this, and having had and having the memories of as a kid, allows you to now that you decide to approach it without a strict philosophical or religious framework, means also that when you meet, I don't know how those interactions in your dream occur, but when you meet that kid and you don't impose, as an adult, you don't impose those rules or frameworks on him or her. I don't know if you dream up explicitly of yourself or just a kid in different forms, but it reminds me that if the reality beyond 3D is beyond time, then we are influencing everybody else and ourselves at not only at every point in our lives as sources of influence, but we are being influenced and influencing each other at all other points in time. So that the fact that you grew up with this figure that was, I mean, was known to you even though you didn't see space, but that figure did not impose something on you, right? It wasn't an oppressive figure. It wasn't giving you a framework. It wasn't pushing you into this. I feel like our openness as adults, or our degree of apprehension is probably a factor in how we felt as a kid, if that makes sense. If we're talking about all of this beyond time, our decisions now and our mental frameworks now are affecting that kid we're remembering. And what do you think about that?
Well, absolutely. That's the whole circular nature I think I was trying to reference. It all comes full circle at some point. And I mean, for the most part, it's staggering and it's quite random at which points, or we perceive them to be quite random at the points at which they happen. But yeah, I think it all comes around full circle. And it's like the Oribus chasing its tail.
Do you
You never
remember?
quite.
Did you read Robert Monroe's second and third, specifically, I think his second book, but I don't remember it was if it was in his second or third book, where he discovers that earlier experiences in which he had helpers, it turns out to be him, like he as he progresses in his development of control over the out of body experience, he finds himself helping people. Or a guy, and then he realizes himself, and he recognizes he has memory of being on the other side, of being the guy being helped. Did you read that before?
Oh yeah. I'm vaguely familiar with Monroe. I read him quite a many years ago, and I haven't revisited him since. And I also yeah, and I think so too. I think there's an interesting personal. I mean, these forces aren't always external. I mean, we internalize them, and there's a lot of interesting ways to explore that type of experience. There's all kinds of we're now getting into the quantum age. We're getting into the quantum science discussion regarding these types of experiences, and so it's very. I find it all very, very fascinating, and I'm not an expert by any stretch. I'm just an interested person, really.
Yeah.
So it's all very, very, very fun, and that's why we try to sit down on a Saturday or a Sunday and talk about them with other like-minded folks.
Well, you reminded me of something else. There's several things because you said these things when they happen, when we're not like orchestrating them, but they just happen. Do you remember that book by what's his name? You say Rudy Rucker, Ruddy Rucker, Ruddy Rucker. It was a mathematician who wrote a book called The Fourth Dimension. You remember that book?
Remember the title.
Remember the
Yeah, I
title?
remember the title. Yeah, I don't think I read it.
It was shared by a very well respected person in certain circles and years ago. And when I enter forums, I like to go deep into the oldest portions of it to see what was the evolution of the community. And so this book, it's about the fourth dimension. And what sticks out to me is the fact that entities that exist outside of just our three dimensions and outside time, when they decide to intrude into our realm, it's he tries to explain it as obviously the old metaphor of you try to understand the fourth dimensional influence on three dimensional space. You try to do it. You try to use the metaphor of how three dimensional space intrudes in two dimensional space. So if you have the flat paper, right, with drawings, which is the two dimensions, and if you put your hand on it, your fingers, it's actually your hand, but if you put your fingers, it looks like it's on it. Then from entities on the two dimensional plane, it looks like it's five different entities intruding in that space, but it's actually just one hand. So he said something like that, where like if an angel were to intrude into our reality, he intrudes in the third as a in one point in time, you're seeing the angel as a three-dimensional figure, but when he enters this space, he enters it at different points in, from his perspective, it's different points in time at this in one swift motion. So his influence, his hand, the fourth dimensional hand or above, enters the three-dimensional time and affects different times in one motion. So I'm starting to think that when we have those experiences, and for us they seem scattered randomly or semi-randomly, they aren't. It's part of something that we may not understand. And I'm not saying this is as part of a belief system. I'm just saying it's possible. I'm trying to make sense of it. I hope I'm not overthinking it, because yesterday night I also stayed up late watching, rewatching Jeffrey Mishlove's interview of Michael Talbot, and not the partial one, but the full 1 hour and a half one. So that was very fascinating too.
Talbot, was that the guy who wrote something about the holographic universe, or am I?
The holographic universe, but more. Wait. Okay, I'm getting excited about this. So I went to look through his bibliography. So Michael Talbot, the last book he wrote was the Holographic Universe, and I think it's a very important book to read, actually. And you know, the Richard Bartlett references him, even in the PDF you sent him. I think this guy is intellectually important in this circles, and he should be read. I mean, you watch the interview and you realize he's a very, very complete mind, and he has a lot of paranormal experiences in his life as well, growing up, like very profound experiences. And so he wrote this book, published it in 1991, but he wrote and published like eight or nine other books, I think, three of which are novels. So his first published book, I don't remember if it was one of the nonfiction books or if it was one of the novels, but his first novel is a novel about vampires. And then the other two are miscellaneous horror novels. And then he has his books on quantum reality and spirituality. But I think what's really powerful about him is that he is not a skeptic about the whole spiritual thing, but he's very and he's very well versed, and he comes at it from the point of view of science as much as he can. I think kind of very much like Richard Bartlett, but even more like a scientist and a philosopher.
Yeah, just to give context, wait, you're not talking about Colin Wilson, are you, regarding the vampire theme? It's
No.
Talbot? Okay. To look into that then. I know Talbot wrote that. But just to give reference to or definition of what you're saying, Richard Bartlett is the founder of Matrix Energetics, as well as other different let's say modalities, Master Energy Dynamics, holosets, things like that. It's on social media. You can type in Matrix Energetics, and the reason why he came up, because in prepping for the interview and the discussion here, he recently passed away on Monday, and it was announced publicly on Tuesday, which was basically the new moon. And you guys know, or yeah, new moon is when the energies are more expansive, say the biological electricity of people, as opposed to like full moon when people's parasites and whatever else is in like full bloom. But it was an interesting timing, and because he's been a big influence as far as my own delvings into consciousness. And I mean, Kalis was mentioning dichotomies. So there are much more useful dichotomies rather than good and evil, which would be useful and useless. And then nowadays you hear more of the terms in, say, social media, whatever. Those who are red pill, those who are not, basically those who are awake, those who are asleep. And thus that's why we have the title Awake versus Aware. And when I pass it over to you, maybe you can give us your definition of awake and aware and the difference of the two. But Richard Bartlett, he wrote two books. The third one is on its way. It's funny. I when I heard of his passing, like, oh man, I got to get his most recent teaching, which is called In Deep Four. And if you go on his the Matrix Energetics Facebook, he still has a bunch of offerings there. But this is his most recent teachings, and he did have a birthday recently, which he went into that. And then the third book is like 800 plus pages, which he previewed in the In Deep Four webinar, which is about 10 parts each, 2 hours, like $450. Way worth it to me. I've only gone through like the first part one, and that's 2 hours, and completely talking about deeper aspects of alignment versus effort when applying the hidden laws of magic, these different technologies that were given by guides or what have you, or passed on, him knowing other practitioners and working with them. I guess we could get into the topic now since we're in deep with it. So there's this thing of like, not so much, I don't know, I was gonna like a cult almost, or like a hero worship or some kind of savior. But to me, he was very much like a father figure, kind of like the time when I've had, I really like LaVey's writings, and before I got into them, he had passed. And then I found out about it. I was like, why do I have this weird feeling over someone's work I haven't even read of? And so when this happened, it hit me pretty hard. And it's a good thing that they have a forum, and people can access it through the Matrix Energetics Facebook page. And in terms of interacting with his, they call it his field, right, or his presence afterwards. And I did get to experience that night, and the timing was, I was sort of an in-between state. And because he works a lot with, I guess in a way to term it, is his term was consciousness technologies, but it was also a form of quantum shamanism, psychic surgery, let's say. If you go into the Matrix Energetics YouTube page and he does stuff with his hands, if you're sensitive enough, or maybe not even, you can pick up what's going on, what he's sending out, right? And so he has a couple books out there, super cheap, Physics of Miracles, getting in deep with those kind of things. But I guess, yeah, because you got to check out some of his material, Winter, and his interview, and it seems like he's all over the place. But the like one of the ones I sent you guys was the interview of Richard Bartlett in Project Camelot back in 2019. And linking to the Matrix Energetics YouTube page, you see the extreme deterioration from how he looked in 2019. It wasn't even HD, right? To what it is now. And then his passing. And so he did have a near-death experience like last month, and talked about it in detail. And he had cancer in his ear. I guess it had to be, it was like cancer was eating in his ear because he was going through his divorce while having the cell phone in his ear. Like, okay, for a guy who wrote Physics of Miracles, and then you have this, you have a stroke. He had one like several months ago. Why would you let that happen to you? Especially since your work is about being in the public presence, putting yourself on video every week, and people looking up to you. When you have that kind of alignment with these not forces per se, but these fields and frequencies that can supposedly fix these things right away. And that's an aspect of, with people who have these gifts. And technically, we all have, we can access these things in our own way, like with your experiences. But that's, I mean, me
Well, I
being
mean
big, it's a,
that's
go ahead.
that, that that's that I mean that's an interesting question because like you said, like you have these tools at your disposal. How does this happen to you? And it's good to realize, you know, at the philosophical level, at least for me, as an immortalist myself, I'm very much okay with the idea of death as it happens to me. The idea in general, no, but as far as it being a process that I have to undertake at some point, I'm okay with that. I don't really think that there's any way around that. I don't try to sweet talk myself into thinking that, you know, this is all just an illusion. I'm gonna die and then I'm gonna wake up, you know, somewhere else, which it could very much be true, but I try to understand, at least philosophically and very physically, that this is something that's probably going to happen to me. And I don't try to get away from it. I don't try to escape from it. I don't try to do anything like that. Illness, disease, death, these things are a part of the human experience. And so when it happens to someone like Dr. Bartlett, it to me kind of serves as a reminder of this reality. Now, what happens next, I think, is entirely up to the individual. I think that's very much the case. But as far as undertaking that specific task of dying and death is I think very much unavoidable. So I try to, in my own mind and especially physically, I try to be at peace with that very concept. I don't try to rage against it. I don't try to rebel. And so, but it is an interesting question. How does someone like that end up, you know, in that sort of physical state, you know, with these technologies? It's that's definitely something to point out and a question to ask for sure.
Yeah, and it's not like he hid it, had it hidden and wasn't going to tell anybody, and then oh, he's gone. Like in the webinars, he was asking for help. Now, if I knew that so many months ago, I would have totally, because I'm in these different intention groups and healing groups that can, you know, work with people long distance, like a Blynn McTaggart, for example, the Power of Eight. Like I'm in this group that meets once a month, and then oh, who do you want to work on this and that? And I've had successes, you know, plural. In which Winter knows where, like these mental technologies, quantum touch, matrix energetics, and Lynn McTaggart's Power of Eight is the same concept of bringing your point of awareness and attention down to your heart space area and project out from there. It's like that old cartoon in the 80s, the Care Bears. It's like that, where you can project your intention, light or energy from there, and then you can get changes, at least in the quantum touch approach, within minutes, if not seconds. And I think the new human is their book of running energy. But anyway, it's a fascinating concept as far as, you know, when you have these deeper approaches of healing and transformation, and where people can take it. Yeah, I mean, because there are things that do reverse aging, as far as, I mean, LifeWave is one of them. As far as what I've researched into, I haven't used them personally, but I've been using other things that Project Camelot has promoted over the years, and I mean, it's working for other stuff. But anyway, yeah, Winter, maybe you could give us your take, and Kalis, of you know, you see this somebody of like high esteem, and then oh, he's gone, and then people are shocked and surprised, and people can get into the social media aspect of the matrix energetic, and people giving their odes and memories and sharing pictures. And now, like, I'll probably, or I offered to host something on Zoom, like if people want to get in and do healings or whatever. And the books are public, so that's cool. Yeah, so there was one tomorrow, actually, if people want to join it. But it looks like, yeah, we're getting out there. And anyway, you guys saw the material, and yeah, what did you think about it?
You shared a PDF that I it looked like it was the slides for a presentation, and it's a workbook too, apparently. It because that's a summarized form with a lot of quotes, I think it was particularly powerful. I find don't ask me right now, but I think it's dense with very useful things for someone who is trying to work with both dreams and waking up in dreams and applying that to the waking state. I think a person who goes into this concept of not just lucid dreaming, but bringing the lucidness that we can develop in dreams into into waking life is Andrew Holesek in his book The Yoga of Lucid Dreaming or something. I cannot remember the exact name of the book, but it's Andrew Holesek. I can maybe type the name later on. And regarding Richard Bartlett and matrix energetics, I mean, I think the first thing that can happen is that people are going to be disappointed. Some people maybe, others are going to justify it. I don't know the context, and I don't know the views of Richard Bartlett enough to understand what he thought. But what I have seen in other cases of people who've had quite recorded high success of paranormal influence, both in mundane events and with health and very incredible stuff, is that they accept death. And I guess this is my with res I don't a moment ago Caelius said that he's an immortalist, but he doesn't rage against death. I agree with that. I don't think emotions have to be brought into it. But I don't accept death in the sense, and I mean in a very peaceful way. It's like I think accepting death is what leads all of these people, even people who have developed very high level of proficiency in mind over matter, if you want to call it like that, influence. And then when their health starts deteriorating and they even face death, they sort of accept it, like, we're human and that's what's gonna happen. And I know I don't like this at all. I think it's defeatist, and it just doesn't make any sense to me. Nothing at all. When a person, for example, who has healed thousands of other people, and many of those cases which may be medically verified, and then this person gets cancer for years and dies. This is weird to me. I mean, did he just accept it was okay to die of cancer? Why wasn't he able to heal himself? I'm going to guess if that person didn't just accept it, there may be other forces at play that we are not fully aware of. And I'm not just saying spiritual warfare. I think it's much more individual centered. It might have to do with ghosts and demons in our own minds. I don't mean the demons of Christianity, but the stuff that's stuck in our own subconscious. There are many things you guys discussed that I realized why professional debaters and professional, I don't know, podcasters, why they keep taking notes. It's because you guys were speaking about so many things that I had like 10 notes in my head, and I can't remember all of them. But Mark, you mentioned awake versus aware, and the way I see these words, what they stand for, aware is, I don't want to give a tautology or a self-evident definition, but aware is being having some sort of focus on the perceptions of what's around you, and even what's going on inside you. I think that is aware. I think awake is one level above that, in which And I this definition comes from, I guess many people have said it this way. I read it last in these words by written by Andrew Holosek, which was to be aware of being aware, the act of observing yourself in the act of observing. I think that's being awake because that really pushes back. You distinguish these two experiences, being aware of being aware. It really pushes your point of consciousness further back, and it goes into dissociation a bit. So yeah, that's my that's so much.
That's a very, very elevated explanation. Perfect. I agree to a very large degree.
Yeah. Thank you. I think it was very useful. Yeah, I just read it in this book, and it made sense with respect to my experiences. And I thought it was very useful also because just using those words, I am able to execute the protocol and become to be aware of being aware, and it just clicks like that. So I think it's very useful to think of it this way.
They both feed into each other.
Right.
We added the verses as a little bonus, as I wouldn't say a trick, but I guess I don't know, Mark, what would you say, like something of a riddle almost? Like what would the verses, as far as Winter's explanation of it, what where would the verses fall into?
I just default to that. I mean, like in the dark places of wisdom, it has that same energy. I mean, I come up with the same thing that you would as far as other reference points.
Yeah, no, it's a catchy name. I'm not gonna lie. I really like it. But yeah, no, there's a reason we put the verses in there, and I'll leave that up as something of a riddle, I suppose, for the listeners.
I'm a little
But
bit
yeah.
confused. What are these verses? I don't even know what we're talking about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So,
The awake versus aware, the verses in the title, the awake versus. Like
sorry. Yes.
there's a sort of dichotomous thing
No.
happening between the two, like the two opposing forces battling for each other, or battling for supremacy.
Sorry, verses. Okay, I was thinking about verses, like poetry verses, and I was like,
Oh.
oh, yeah. I was like, what are we talking about? Yeah.
My apologies.
I mean, just to give a bigger context, because like Project Kamut, Kerry Cassidy does have these monthly, not monthly, yearly conferences called Awake and Aware. You'd think the two, I mean, technically the two would work with each other, but we're coming into a time where you have, again, with the dichotomy blue pill and red pill, and then now like red pills just become almost meaningless because you're going into these spirals within spirals of things where what does it mean now that certain let's say independent, so-called independent, or maybe decentralized circles are infiltrated and hijacked. And you have gatekeepers, which, like in any group, there's going to be hierarchy and there's going to be change, evolution, and it's like with anything, a constant flux of back and forth, and like so during the Matrix, the movies, you have we knew what it meant to be awake, and then now, or for many years, you have the term woke, right? And so now that you have, at least in the Western political right, you have the woke right, or the red wokes is some of the more used terms in those circles. And yeah, that's what I'm referring to as far as the versus part in awake versus aware, because awareness is different degrees, and there's more depth to it, as opposed to the black and white of just being awake. Now, for our own purposes here, my dichotomy for it is waking up in dreams is lucid dreaming. in this 3D reality, when you wake up in this 3D reality, there's obviously degrees. So that's the awareness part. And as far as the spiritual aspect, there's a term called lucid waking, which I got to experience, what, 15 years ago or something. And Dr. Bartlett was recalling an experience. He has these stories in the In Deep Four class where the distinction between you as an individual and identity versus what's out there, whoops, dissolves. And it's like what is out there is you. There's no, it's like it's a projection of you. And I got to experience that. And it was like, I mean, it was this kind of deep joy or something. It was just this whole other thing. And those are the kind of experiences, meeting guides. I did some very Inception-like stuff of hosting out-of-body experiences in sacred sites. That was fun, especially the Jinn headquarters in the Middle East. I got to do that. And yeah, so I mean, that's what I'm talking about as far as what the direction of this show is and the people we talk to and the topics we comment on, like these recordings. And
Yeah, may I ask more about the whole Middle East thing you mentioned? Like you glossed over it, and I was like, "What? You talked about jinn and the Middle East? Can you what was
yeah, I
that?"
think I've in the occult forums, you mentioned I did put up something years and years ago, but the reference initial reference for it was the Coast to Coast AM radio station in the US with an author, Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and she wrote a couple of Jinn books, the Jinn Connection, and there was one other one. And there was just this gravity pull towards it. It's like, okay, what is this? And I got into this rhythm of hosting out-of-body experiences. For example, at one of the cathedrals in France, the Egyptian pyramids, places like that, Archaeum in Russia, I think it was. And so one of them was, I'm probably saying it wrong, Majlis Al Jinn. I forget the location, but th there's a space in the forums where we can propose these kinds of things. And a future one was Darth Vader's castle I wanted to do, but it's just like I got over it. Maybe revisit sometime again. But so, oh, I got to go there and a bunch of people too. And I timed it precisely to be on New Moon because that's when the gates are more open as far as your mind, energy, and stuff out there. And it was like a combination of New Year's Eve and Halloween, like a carnival, a circus. It just had that kind of, if you've seen the movie Mirror Mask, it was kind of like that. But yeah, just the whole party and like being with family and that whole thing. And people who delve deeper into the archives of this radio station, Cosmic Reality, they're also big on the Djinn and they work with the Djinn too. Nancy Hopkins and Walt Silva, they've done projects with them. Even in the Mecca's Black Cube, there's Shungite and Djinn that were trapped in there that they helped to release. So something for people to dig into. but anyway, and I think I posted that in the Facebook group Shungite Reality, which I help with. I posted the exact show and then the quote and all that stuff. So as far as that goes, like I could go there whenever I want. I feel like I have an open invitation, and the beings, at least the ones that I interacted with, were just people like us, but maybe wilder and more party-like. So very much like Mutual Admiration Society or family, have you guys anything had like that, like dream experiences, even out of body stuff? Those are the ones that just, I have a dream journal, and those are the ones to just stand out for the rest of your life.